Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Guardians of the Holy Grail, the program that's dedicated to diving deep to uncover and expose the truth behind the Knights Templar, the Secret Societies, and the ancient Holy Grail mysteries. The Guardians of the Holy Grail program was created by me in order to clear up many of the popular misconceptions that have been floating around regarding the Holy Grail mysteries and the bloodline from Jesus and Mary Magdalene, the Knights Templar, the Freemasons, and all the other secret societies. A lot of misconceptions that have been floating around that came from, you know, films and novels and you name it has left a lot of people pretty confused. So through this show, I'm hoping to set the record straight, if you will, and introduce hard facts from authors and researchers as well as testimonials from current and past members of the Knights Templar, Freemasonry, and other initiatic societies. As many of you know, I myself am a Knight Templar of the International Order of Gnostic Templars, which was founded to revive the mystical rites and Gnostic wisdom of the original Knights Templar that over the centuries has either been lost or ignored. And you can learn more about us, our Gnostic Templar organization, at www.gnostictemplars.org. You can find all kinds of information there. There's some videos of myself explaining different facets of our organization. You can sign up for the mailing list. You can purchase the 18-lesson Gnostic Knight Templar e-course. There's all kinds of great stuff there. So please visit it and take a look. Now, today's show, you're welcome to call in with questions if you have any for myself or our guest, and feel free to call on our toll-free number, which is 866-472-5795. Today's going to be a great show. We're going to be talking with the internationally known and best-selling author James Wasserman, who's got an amazing amount of information. We're going to be talking with him about the infamous society known as the Assassins, which, as you know, coexisted with the Knights Templar during their years in the Holy Land. But they've been given a bad rap. Well, the Knights Templars have too, but it doesn't compare with the bad rap the Assassins have been given over time. And so we're going to explore these assassins. Were they simply bloodthirsty cutthroats, or is there more to that story? We welcome James to our show to help us separate fact from fiction and hopefully get to the truth of what the assassins were all about. Now, our guest, James Wasserman, has been a lifelong student of religion and spiritual development. In 1976, he joined the Ordo Templo Orientis, which is also known as the OTO. And in 1979, he founded the Tehuti Lodge, which is the third oldest OTO lodge in the world. James's books, and he's a very prolific writer, James's books on the secret societies and Western spirituality include an illustrated history of the Knights Templar, which offers the richest collection of Templar imagery in print anywhere, and I can attest to that. I have a copy of it myself. He's also published The Mystery Tradition, Secret Symbols, and Sacred Art, which explains closely held esoteric teachings with clarity and understanding. James's book that we're going to be most closely focused on today is called The Templars and the Assassins, The Militia of Heaven. And it's a great book, and it's the only book of its kind that I know of. I highly recommend it. There aren't too many that talk about the Assassins, the Templars, and really gives a true explanation about them according to facts, and also talks about their interaction together. All that is very, very important information. James has also written screenplays, including one that's entitled Divine Warriors, The Birth of Heresy. So greetings, James, and a big welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. You're so kind. I appreciate being on.
Well, it's just a pleasure and an honor to have you on here. You, on the show. You've been kind of an idol in a sense of my own. I'm a researcher, and you're just, I think you're just a fabulous one. So it's great to have you on.
Well, thank you again. It's really a pleasure. It's so nice to be talking to someone who's as interested in the assassins as you are, because they really have fascinated me for a very, very long time. And the screenplay, The Divine Warriors, is actually, it's the only one I've written. But it's like a novelization of the interaction between the Templars and the Assassins, you know, based on facts. I mean, it's a little loose. It's a novel in that sense, but it's what you would call a historical novel. Some of it is true and some of it isn't. And in my book, I tried to be very specific and really factual, and I really separated my opinion from what I was reporting. And when I gave my opinion, I made sure to say "in my opinion" or something like that, you know. In the screenplay, of course, I play a little faster and looser with the truth, you know, where you're allowed to, and but at the same time, I almost think I get at the real truth.
Well, that's what I'm wondering, James. If you get on the internet or if you go searching for information about the assassins, you find it's kind of hard to come by, and the most you can find is just really derogatory, negative information. So how do you go about your research? Where did you find your information?
Well, there are a number of good books on the subject. I would say the best one overall that I remember, I'm trying to find it here on my shelves, is one that at the time that I was searching for it, of course, was out of print, as so much of this stuff is. Now it's available in paperback. I paid a fortune for this copy, but it's called The Order of Assassins by Marshall Hodgson. There's Bernard Lewis, who is just a brilliant, brilliant writer on Islam, also did a book called The Assassins, and I've seen that one in paperback recently. Those two are invaluable. Two of the books that are a little more one book by there's a fellow named Farad Daftari, Daftary. He's got three books on them, but one of them is called The Assassin Legends, and that's a real interesting one because that goes through the kind of undermining and scandalous slanders that were spread about them, and kind of examines how the Sunnis, you know, attacked them. But what was funny was that the Shias attacked them too, even though they're a Shiite offset. They are so off into the wilderness that they have been on basically everybody's enemies list for a very long time.
And I guess you, like myself, doesn't think that's really very fair, huh?
No, I don't. I don't. I think the worst accusation made against them was their, you know, their violence and their kind of murderous activities. And they actually kept a list of the people that they killed, and there were something like 50 people killed during a period of 35 years of the reign of their founder, Hassani Sabah. And, you know, that's like compared to many other military campaigns, that's a small number. What they did was they chose people who were really dangerous to them. You know, they included, you know, rulers, political advisors who in some cases, you know, if you had a ruler who was either favorable toward the assassins or unconcerned with them, they often had advisors who would develop these obsessions, you know, with attacking the assassins, and so they would kill these people. There were also professors at the various colleges and universities, or high-ranking clerics who would go out and preach against, you know, their sect. So they would arrange to assassinate them. They never killed other people in their attempts. They were very surgical. In other words, they weren't like these terrorist, indiscriminate murderers. They would use a dagger, and they would do it in broad daylight, and they would sacrifice themselves, because the powerful people that they were, you know, would go up against were most often surrounded by guards. They didn't survive their assassination attempts. Now, you could say, well, gee, that suicide bombing, don't survive it either. But the difference is that they were killing cleanly the people responsible for the policies that were hurting their community. They were not going after women and children and you know, business guy people at the World Trade Center. I mean, other Shiites in mosques, or you know, people waiting at bus stations. It wasn't like that kind of phenomena. I was very sensitive to this because my book was published before 9/11, and you know, in fact, about 6 months before 9/11. And then I thought, oh my God, people are going to think that I've written something friendly to, you know, Bin Laden and crew, and that was not the case. So I wrote something else and published it elsewhere, trying to explore the difference between, you know, these warrior mystics, the assassins and the Knights Templar, and you know, these indiscriminate murderers like Al-Qaeda and allied organizations, Hezbollah and Hamas. Very, well, very different.
Tell me, James, what kind of person would you say that Hassan Hissab Sabah was, and what did he intend to accomplish through creating the assassins?
Well, you know, when you're talking about somebody who lived 1,000 years ago, I think the first thing that I need to establish is, you know, that I don't really know, honestly. However, what I believe is that, and what my research suggests, is that he was a very independent person who was a religious visionary, and he had he had an illness at a very young age. I think he was 17, and he had been approached by the Ismailis, and his doctrine was Shiite. He was what's known as a 12-er Shiite. The ones that are in charge of Iran and all the other places in the Mideast, the predominant version of Shiite Islam is called 12-er Shiite. Anyway, he was one of those. His family was one of those. And he was approached by a missionary who was teaching a variation of that doctrine known as Ismailism, or Sevener Shiite, like, because they viewed seven imams. And he got sick and experienced a religious conversion during his illness. And when he recovered, he became you know, a deep student of this teacher and the next teacher, and kind of worked up the line in Iran. Actually, he was born in near Tehran, and grew up around, you know, near Tehran, and eventually was told that he should go to Egypt and study with the, you know, the higher levels of this academy. There was a university in Cairo that offered further teachings on Ismailism. And he went, and he met the Fatimid Caliph at the time, who was very impressed with him. But there was a political upheaval going on in Egypt, and Hassan was imprisoned because of his adherence to this teaching and his threat to the other people who were the military. There was a military coup taking place, and the general who was pursuing this was kind of weakening the power of the caliph, and the caliph was viewed as what was called an imam. It's a term I think we're becoming increasingly familiar with, but he was like the spiritual teacher of the Ismailis. And anyway, Hassan was imprisoned. And there's a story that the prison tower that he was being kept in actually collapsed. And, you know, people attributed this to his spiritual power. You know, it's part of the legend, the ever-growing legend about Hassani Sabah. He then, you know, left Cairo on a ship, and there was like a great storm in the Mediterranean, and he was unconcerned, and he kept a certain calm, and you know, rode through this horrible, frightening storm, and the sailors and the passengers like looked at him and they couldn't believe it. You know, they were terrified, and he was an example of this kind of faith and confidence of a kind of person who, you know, has a spiritual essence to his personality. Well, when they landed safely, some of these people began to follow and attach themselves to him. And the university that he attended in Cairo was like a training school for missionaries. So he went off to, you know, to do this kind of missionary recruiting, and you know, it was a very dangerous thing to do because the 12 are Shiites, the normal majority Shiites viewed the Ismaili doctrine, the 7 are Shiite doctrine, as heretical. So, you know, we're already looking at a guy who was a bit of a rebel, you know, in the sense that he kind of went after a dangerous teaching, so to speak. So much of a rebel that he wound up in jail because he kind of, you know, he was, you know, I'm not going to say a big mouth, but he was somebody who was very firm in his convictions, let's say, and wouldn't, so antagonized the general who was threatening the caliph, the imam, the man that Hassan looked up to, you know, that he wound up in jail. And then he went off on his own and started proselytizing and organizing and you know, doing this missionary work in an environment in which he was actually liable to capital punishment. So we know that he was brave. And, you know, he did this for a couple of years, in the regions of, you know, what is today Iran, up in the mountainous areas. A lot of those mountainous areas were peopled by, you know, some very independent, tribes and groups, the same way as the, you know, they're always talking about the mountains of Pakistan, where Al-Qaeda is supposedly, you know, growing and working with the Taliban. They always talk about it as being these isolated tribal areas. Well, it's the same in northern Iran, up by the Caspian Sea region, where Hassani Sabah was preaching. And he one day found a valley and a castle that was on a huge rock in this valley. And he looked at it and he said that this might be, you know, a place where it would be good for him to settle his community. So he, you know, researched it, and sure enough, it was. And that was called Alamut, or Eagle's Teaching. And it was impregnable in the sense that it was, you know, it was, the castle itself was on a rock. The valley was very narrow, so you had to go through these mountain ranges on either side to approach it, and then there was only one pathway or entrance to Alamut. So he fell in love with it and sent some of his disciples up there to kind of infiltrate the guard of the castle itself, you know, the guard force, the little army or the little militia that was held by the owner of the castle. And at a certain point, he smuggled himself into the castle, or had himself smuggled into the castle, and he said to the owner, you know, I'm taking the castle, and, you know, here is a check, you know, a letter to someone asking for them to give the owner a large sum of gold. And the guy looked at it and said, yeah, right, this will never happen. But he had no opportunity to, you know, to battle Hassan. So he did that. He went off, he left his castle and went off to Hassan's disciple, presented the piece of paper, and the person who received it immediately, like, you know, kind of clutched at their heart in love and admiration for Hassan, and gave the former castle owner the sum of money that Hassan had requested. So we know that he was very charismatic, and we know that he was an honest person.
Well, from what I understand, James, didn't Hassani Sabahi, he created a mystery school that was somewhat modeled after this House of Wisdom place that he studied in Cairo, is that right?
Well, sure, but that's what I was getting to. I mean, that's where the House of, you know, the mystery school that he created was among his disciples at the castle of Alamut. That's where he established himself for the next 35 years. And by all means, Mark, you're absolutely right. That's exactly what he did. He worked on doctrine. He, you know, taught his students, and he, you know, managed the community, and he tried to spread the teachings. Now, that's the kind of the next thing that happens is that, you know, we try to understand what was it he was really teaching, and that goes back to this coup d'etat that was taking place in Cairo. The imam, or the caliph, the Fatimid caliph, had two sons, one of whom had been granted this succession, what they called Nas, or the spiritual teaching that the imam had was kind of passed. It was like a magical force that was passed on to his eldest son, designating him as the new leader. Well, this general that we talked about earlier decided that the younger son would be far easier to work with, because he was far less experienced. So he said that the younger son was to be the next caliph, or let's say king and spiritual leader after the death of the father. Well, the eldest son went into battle to fight for his right to the imam designation and the caliphate. And according to some people, he was killed. Hassan taught that he was the successor imam, that this fellow named Nizar was in fact the real imam, and that the thing that had happened with the general and the coup d'etat was illegitimate. Because the imam, Mark, to give you, I mean, there's one thing I left out of this whole, you know, craziness. The imam was the direct descendant of Muhammad through Ali and Fatima. Fatima, of course, was Muhammad's daughter, and Ali was her husband. So he was Muhammad's son-in-law. And the descendants of Ali and Fatima were the spiritual leaders of the Shiite community. And as that event got further and further in history, I mean, Muhammad died somewhere, you know, in the 7th century, and we're up in the 11th century now. In fact, you know, Hassan started his teaching around 1095, big time. That's when he acquired Alamut. Much of his doctrine, you know, was actually going in the 1100s, which is the 12th century. So we're quite a bit away from Muhammad. But in any case, he was teaching the Nizari Ismaili doctrine, which included first the idea that, you know, that the Sunnis were illegitimate because, you know, they didn't have the spiritual wisdom of Muhammad, which can only flow through his bloodline. And then, you know, the Ismailis, the majority of Shiites were illegitimate because they didn't recognize the correct succession branching off at the seventh imam. They actually accepted 12, you know, 12 imams, and there were only really seven. And then, you know, the Sevener Shiites were wrong because, or Ismailis, the majority of Ismailis were wrong because they didn't accept Nizar as the correct successor. So it's like you're getting further and further and further into this field of, you know, this thing, and Hassan is like out in the middle of nowhere teaching a doctrine about a guy who presumably was dead. You know, Nizar, the son of the eldest son of the Egyptian caliph. So it gets pretty wacky, but he sent missionaries to Syria, and he sent missionaries to various and actually into India as well, and he sent missionaries to some of the surrounding areas around Alamut, around this Caspian Sea area of northern Iran, and started to develop like a kind of a political warrior state that allowed for and encouraged, you know, these religious beliefs. It's kind of like, you know, in a certain way, it's almost like the Pilgrims. You know, they left England where they were not able to you know, to do their teaching, and then, you know, came to the New World where they were. Well, these you know, these Nizari Ismailis were isolated communities in mountain ranges, and they pursued their teachings and their religious beliefs there.
Well, James, what I'm really fascinated about is this the mystery school that Hassani Sabah founded in Alamut. And I know that at some point he actually gained the reputation of being one of the great alchemists of Persia. So I'm really curious, what information do you have about his mystery school? I understand there was 9 levels to it. Exactly what were the practices, the alchemy, the gnosis, the yoga, whatever it was, what information do you have about what this mystery school was all about?
Well, being brutally honest, I would have to say virtually nothing, because in the 1200s, like around 1250, the Alamut was completely decimated by the Mongol invasion, and these folks were so whacked out, they were so far out of the mainstream of the surrounding Islam, that they were in a state of nearly continuous warfare for the whole period of their existence. 160 years is what's considered the military state of the Nizari faith. Now, they are alive today, and they're under the leadership of the Aga Khan. So there are quite several million Nizari Ismailis in the world today. But at this time, there was a lot fewer, and the 9 degrees of initiation that were discussed, that were attributed to them, were actually like a criticism. They were viewed as teaching, Hassan was viewed as teaching this kind of really evil heresy, and people were executed for having subscribed to these 9 degrees. But they were, the information that we have about them mostly comes from people who were lying about them. Now, this gets a little bit confusing because, if you've read something like The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, we all know that stuff is complete nonsense when it's applied to the Jews. We know that it was started by some, Russian anti-Semites in the early 1900s and, blah, blah, blah. I mean, that thing has been unmasked a million times. But the essential message that it's talking about, there is a certain truth to it, that there's a organized group of people who are trying to break down the moral structures of Western society. And we can see this every day, you don't have to look much beyond your own television or the newspapers to see what the hell is going on with that stuff. So there was a certain truth to it. There's another book of a similar nature that was put out in the 1960s called The Report from Iron Mountain on the Possibility and Desirability of Peace. And this thing was actually exposed by the authors of the thing in the 1990s as being, a bit of a fake. But what they did in 1960s was, they spoke about this sort of global warming hoax and how it would be necessary to, create some sort of artificial enemy out there so that to organize society if you didn't have real wars going on. And so there's a lot of truth to these things. They're called travesties. They're called satires, travesties, and whatnot. And one the earliest information we can find on this is one called the Book of the Highest Initiation. And that's the one that presented, the so-called 9 degrees. Now, I'm going to just, tell you, which I explain in some detail in my book, that this is a bit of a stretch, to know what they were teaching. But they basically tried to get people to understand that there was a meaning behind the Quran, that there was an esoteric meaning, a hidden meaning, and that if the student was open to that, they could be introduced to some of these other doctrines. They would be questioned on, let's say, the meaning of life. And they would be, you know, they would, the kind of standard responses of Sunni doctrines would be given to them, and they would, you know, does this really solve your problem? Do you think that, you know, being told to pray to Mecca is going to really result in your spiritual illumination? And the disciples, you know, all this time, you know, their entire lives, they would be like, you know, of course, you know, it's like a Christian today or something. I mean, any religious person has certain doctrines that, you know, you're taught from the time of childhood. So there would be a breakdown of these childhood messages, and a kind of encouragement of a lack of faith in those things. And then they would start to show that there was a superior wisdom out there, which they could learn from the teacher. You know, this was all done, by the way, on a one-on-one basis. This was not, there was a conversion process going on here, and it was really, you know, starting out with a, you know, one-to-one teaching between these DAIs, they were called, D-A-I, these representatives, these missionaries from the Nazari school. Then according to at least this scheme, you know, that I publish in the book, the next they would start to learn about Kabbalistic mysteries, and they would be especially focused on the number 7, because if you recall, I told you that these people were called Seveners, or descendants of the Sevener Shiites, and they would kind of go through all of these correspondences, the 7 heavens, planets, colors, metals, and so forth, and that there were 7 divine Ismaili teachers. And they would learn the names of these teachers and the words of power that invoked them. And they would be immediately separated from the larger Shiite community, because the Shiites accepted 12. And then they would go further on, and they would, you know, they would just, it's kind of interesting. I mean, a lot of the teaching that they were exposed to would be what we would call Gnosticism. You know, I think you and I share the belief, you know, in our interest in the Templars, is that there's a belief that somehow the message of God is within each one of us and capable of being discovered through mystical practices. I mean, is that true? I'm sure it's true of you from what I've seen of your website.
Well, we do call ourselves the International Order of Gnostic Templars, absolutely. We do believe that the Templars during their time in the Holy Land were became connected to Gnostic and alchemical movements, and they incorporated a lot of those Gnostic alchemical practices from the Kabbalah, from the Sufis, from the Johannites into their tradition, and went back into Europe and practiced these mysteries. And yes, we believe that was a major goal of every the higher up of the Templars to achieve that.
Absolutely. That's exactly the way that I feel too. And I think that a lot of what I perceive as this Gnostic current was what was being taught by the assassins. And especially in the film Divine Warriors, in my screenplay, I really turn this into like a dramatic thing. I have my Templar character going to the Assassin Castle, which actually happened, and then being exposed to magic and meditation and invocation and the kind of standard run of things that we learn in the Gnostic in the Gnostic traditions. What the most famous, I think, of the ninth, teaching of the ninth degree, so to speak, or at least what this document called the ninth degree, is, the idea that nothing is true, everything is permitted. And I take exception with that in my book, in my discussion of it, that it's what they criticized Hassan for in supposedly saying that, they said that he was teaching a form of atheism, and that if at the end of this process of discovery of the true meaning of life and all of these different doctrines between dualism and magic, Kabbalah, alchemy, meditation, and perhaps sexual doctrines, all of these kinds of things that at the very end you would sort of be taught, like in the Golden Dawn, Osiris is a black god, or there is no god, or any of this stuff. I think it's, it was almost the opposite. At the end of that whole course of instruction, you could say nothing is true, everything is permitted, because you would have become a self-aware being, who incarnated the divine reality of God, and in fact you would be so spiritually attuned to the wisdom of the universe within yourself that you would no longer need either teachers or clergymen or these bizarre ritualized forms of behavior which Muhammad had given to to basically tribesmen and the masses of people, ignorant and whatnot, to keep them in line and to help them become a more civilized people. My God, the people that Muhammad was teaching used to kill baby girls because they would think of it was another mouth to feed. So he was an enormously civilizing force among the Arab tribes. But Hassan would say something to the effect of, at least Hassan, as I believe he was, would say something to the effect of, hey, we're no longer these, unsophisticated people. You can have the message of spiritual truth. You're kind of open enough to that by the practices which we've learned here in this mystical academy, that you can connect with the imam directly. And that is the essence of Gnosticism and spiritual progress.
Well, my next question to you, James, is your screenplay sounds very fascinating about Templar entering into the mystery tradition of the Assassins. How much of that is actually based on true? How much contract was there between the Templars and the Assassins?
Well, that we know now, Mark. We know for a fact that there was quite a bit. I mean, they were both in the same area, and they had battles together. In some cases, one or the other one would win, and there would be treaties, and the Assassins at several points, usually the Templars would win somehow, and they would exact these tributes. So there was like high taxes or something, and people would go to collect them, and then there were various levels of interaction in the daily life of people in that region. But you know, by treaty at least. I had mentioned earlier, let me backtrack just a second here. I had mentioned earlier that Hassan Isabah had sent a mission to Syria. The Syrian Templars are the ones the Syrian assassins were the ones who met the Knights Templars, who would, you know, come to that region for the Crusades. So we're not really talking about Alamut when we talk about the interaction between the Knights Templars and the Syrian assassins. But sure, they were talking all the time. One of the really most famous stories of the day was immortalized by John Milius in that funny movie Conan the Barbarian. And, you know, in that that fellow, there's a scene there where he had the leader of this group of renegades was motioned to two people to leap off a mountain cliff. That's actually something that happened, at least as far as we know, in around 1190 when the king of Jerusalem went to visit the assassin headquarters and speak to the old man of the mountain, as he was known. And the old man, you know, and the King Henry were walking, and you know, the old man said, I don't think that your Christians are as loyal as my assassin soldiers. And King Henry said, no, I disagree with you. You know, our warriors are great and strong, and you know, they believe in Christ and God and all the rest of it, and they're very loyal. And so the old man motioned to two of his soldiers, fidais they were called, you know, disciples, F-I-D-A-I-S, loosely, and they leapt to their death from the mountaintop. And, you know, Henry was just stunned because, you know, the assassin leader had proven, in fact, that you know, he was right, that his Henry soldiers would never have done that. It's not part of our Western culture to do things like that. So there was plenty of interaction between the two groups. Now, what we don't have, and, you know, what I don't pretend to, you know, to be able to show anybody, is a, you know, like an initiation certificate from the assassins to the Templars, or for that matter, from the Templars to us in this modern day. You know, nothing is on paper. But what we have is a certain supposition, and we have a certain sense of their doctrines. Look at it this way. The Templars were violating one of the core principles of Christianity prior to their establishment, you know, the thou shalt not kill. The Templars were established as these divine warriors. You know, they killed in the name of God. You know, they killed to advance their religion. They killed for holiness. They killed for, as a religious obligation, to spread the word of Christ through the land of the infidel. The assassins were set up exactly the same. They were doing precisely the same thing. Any one of their assassinations was based solely on the idea of overcoming any sort of interference with the teachings of the imam, the teachings of the higher spiritual truth of their beliefs. They were they were virtually identical in that part of their teachings, And I just find it, you know, extremely fascinating that that was the case.
Well, one thing that I've come across in my research, and I'm sure you have too, is the exalted status of this the old man on the mountain, Rashid al-Din Sinan. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but apparently he kind of considered himself to be an enlightened master, and not only that, but like a Christed being, and he kind of encouraged his disciples to also see him that way. And so I imagine that they're jumping to them death from a high precipice was a little bit different, because they saw him as a truly enlightened Christed being that was probably totally in charge of their spiritual journey in this life and in the next life, you know. So what can you tell me about this master Sinan?
Well, you, Mark, you have this characterized so perfectly that there's very little I have to tell you. I mean, you've got it down. I keep using the term. I know it's so hard to run around these terms, but like the word imam, that's exactly what it was. I mean, there was a hidden imam who was, let's say, behind. You know, he was the, you know, something, this lunatic in Iran, Ahmadinejad, was trying to call forth, I don't know if you remember, a couple of years ago he was in New York at the UN, and he was invoking the 12th imam. I don't know if you recall that, but in any case, this actually happened. He was invoking the 12th imam from the, you know, pulpit or of the UN, and very few newspapers commented on it, but the 12th imam is like this kind of hidden spiritual force whose coming is very much like the way that, you know, people describe the beliefs of the let's say evangelical right, as far as the, you know, the end of the world coming by Jesus returning to earth. So Ahmadinejad was essentially invoking the apocalypse on earth. But this, the Ismailis, the Nizaris, you know, the assassins, had a far more exalted conception of this being, and they didn't, you know, he wasn't like the end of time. He wasn't as apocalyptic, but he was the spiritual director, very much like our Christ of the world. And he had certain highly placed agents who were, let's say, the lesser imams. And Sinan was viewed as being kind of in between. He might have perhaps been the hidden imam, or he might be the hidden imam's representative. Hassani Sabah called himself the representative. Some of the imams at Alamut were considered to be, you know, the kind of incarnation of the hidden imam himself, and Sinan very definitely may have been considered one or the other as well. I present him in my screenplay, or, you know, what probably will become a novel someday, because it's impossible to you know, to sell a screenplay, it seems like, anyway. At least it's been taking years, and I'm getting nowhere with it. But in the, you know, I present him as like a, you know, an evolved spiritual master, the same way that you or I might, have known in our lives, someone that, you know, you or I might have taken direction from, you know, a highly advanced individual. And I don't get into that stuff. I make it much more, you know, I pattern him after my own experiences, you know, on the spiritual path. But he was viewed with such magical powers. I tell a couple of stories in the book of of, let's say, Saladin, you know, the famous Sunni general who and ruler who sent at one point who was an enemy of the assassins, and you know, he had supposedly attacked Sinan's castle, and his soldiers were stopped by an invisible wall that Sinan had magically erected. And another, you know, incident that, you know, Saladin was a fierce enemy of the assassins because they were so heretical, you know, and all of a sudden he stopped arguing with them. And people have tried to understand why. One of the explanations was that Sinan had sent a disciple to Saladin's camp while he was asleep and put a dagger in the ground right next to his head and with a note attached to it, and you know, Saladin awoke, and he of course had the guards, you know, throughout the tent and the area of his tent, sleeping quarters, and you know, the note said, had this, you know, had I chosen, I would have had this dagger placed in your heart, you know, and at that point Saladin allied himself with Sinan. And another story that's told of him is that he was he went to visit, you know, one of the communities, and you know, the sort of leader of the community that in Syria that he went to visit had laid out a beautiful spread of food for him and gave him a special dish, and Sinan didn't open the dish, and the man was very disappointed and felt somewhat insulted, and you know, Sinan quietly took him aside and said, you know, your wife was so excited when she made this lovely dish that she forgot to clean the inside of the chickens or something, and I didn't want to embarrass you. And the guy was like astounded at his good manners and his kindness, you know. He was never seen to eat. That's spoken of constantly in stories of him. And at later times, he was believed to have been directly translated, you know, into heaven.
Well, I understand that, you know, from the time of one of Hassan's successors, Hassan II, there was this idea of the teachings of the resurrection, the day of resurrection, that kind of passed down amongst the heads of the assassin order. And I guess it's kind of like another apocalypse waiting. You know, this was the end of times. And so I'm thinking, do you think maybe they considered Sinan the avatar or the Messiah of that movement of the Day of Resurrection?
Well, he was one of them. There were a couple of them, and you know, it's interesting. I'm just delighted that you're so aware of this stuff, because you know, it's really profound. They overturned Islam completely. They decided that they had this Hassan II, and he's the one who figures. I'm gonna after we get off the phone, I'm gonna arrange to send you the screenplay. I think you'll get a kick out of it.
Oh, thank you. That'll be great.
Yeah, you'll. You're going to enjoy it. But the, you know, this Hassan II basically said that all of Islam was overturned, that the assassin community had entered into a state of perfect grace, perfect enlightenment, perfect spiritual freedom, and had no more need for any further practices of Islam or reading of the Quran or bowing to Mecca or not fasting or fasting during Ramadan or any of this stuff. All that stuff was the old way, and that, you know, the assassin community had been sort of like elevated to direct contact with God. I don't know if that's even the apocalypse, but it, I mean, on a certain way it is, I guess. You know what I mean? It's like there was no destruction. It was really the kingdom of heaven had come to earth. So, so there they were. Well, he was killed very soon after making that proclamation. And, but Sinan, in particular, was one of his dear friends and disciples, and he is the one who went to Syria and introduced this Qiyamah doctrine to the assassin community there, and he managed to live for a very long time after that. So he was very definitely a master of the Qiyamah and a highly regarded spiritual figure in that, you know, imminence of the kingdom of God on earth. It gets pretty wacky.
Well, it gets very, very intriguing. There's a lot there that nobody has a clue about, which I find very fascinating. You know, I think we've pretty much covered as much territory as we can today, James. I would certainly like to have you back on the show because I can see that we could probably go for another 5 hours if we wanted to.
It's fun talking.
By now that you are definitely a bottomless pit of information, and I'm sure they're very appreciative of that fact.
Well, I feel the same way about you. You know, I mean, I wouldn't be enjoying myself so much if it weren't for the intelligence of your questions and the fact that, you know, you're talking about things which you know, a lot of people don't know about. So it's a pleasure to speak with you too, and I'd love to come back let's do
great.
That. Great.
Well, thank you so much, James. We'd like you to come back and talk more about the assassins and also the OTO. We haven't actually had a representative of that sect come on and give us a good explanation about the history and the teaching. So if you could come on and talk to us about that, that would be super as well.
That would be my pleasure, my friend. We will definitely talk again.
Well, thank you again, James, and we'll be in touch. And those of you that want to read more about James's work, certainly from today's discussion, you might want to pick up a copy of The Templars and the Assassins, The Militia of Heaven, which is actually published by Destiny Books. And then there's a number of books by Inner Tradition that have published James's work. So visit Inner Tradition's website and look for more of James's work. There's a lot there. Next week we're going to have on Rob Howell, who actually is an authority on the Priory of Sion, and he's a contactee of the members of the Priory, which is unusual in this day and age. So we get to hear all about him. He was actually one of the main consultants on the Bloodline documentary film, which I know a lot of you have seen. So you're not going to want to miss that show. And so in the meantime, have a wonderful week. And always remember that the Holy Grail exists right inside all of you. Bye for now.